Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. If you're a fan of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, or a fan of those late, great Johnny Cash recordings, then you've heard Ben Montench at the keyboard. He was a founding member of the Heartbreakers, and he's played with Bob Dylan, U2, the Rolling Stones, and today, he'll play for us here in the studio. We're also going to look at a single sequence of four notes that appears in hundreds of very different pieces of music, and once you hear our segment about it, I can guarantee that you will find some examples of it in your own record collection, no matter what kind of music you like. But we're spending part of Soundcheck this week talking about the most romantic song ever. Actually, what we're really doing is we're looking for the most romantic song ever, and everyone seems to have an opinion.
Oh my gosh, I have to say Stevie Ray Vaughan's Lenny. It's all guitar. There's no words, but when you listen to this song, he wrote it for his wife. When you listen to this song, you begin to wonder what it must have been like to be his wife, to be married to a man who can play a guitar like that.
I think the most romantic song ever is a version of the song But Beautiful, performed by Bill Evans and Tony Bennett.
If you were mine, I'd never let you go. And that would be but beautiful.
I really, really like Just My Imagination by The Temptations, because haven't we all been in a situation where we really had such feelings for someone and yet it was just all in our imagination?
But it was just my imagination running away with me. It was just my imagination.
All good choices, though if you're going to talk about that Tony Bennett, Bill Evans record, how do you look past My Foolish Heart? Such a great song. Anyway, that's the fun of this endeavor. There is no right answer, or they're all right answers. So give us your choice for most romantic song ever. Tell us the song and why you think it's the most romantic. Our number is 866-939-1612, or you can leave a comment at soundcheck.org. Again, that number, 866-939-1612. So yeah, we're doing this because Friday is Valentine's Day, but remember, there's another reason that people are thinking about love songs and romance right now.
Oh yeah, tell me something. I think you understand.
This past weekend marked the 50th anniversary of the Beatles' first television performance here in the States. They were on The Ed Sullivan Show on February 9th, 1964, and the next two Sundays as well, and our nation hasn't been quite the same since. But today, we thought we'd take a look at the Beatles on the big screen. And joining me are Kristen Meinzer and Rafer Guzman, co-hosts of the Takeaways Movie Date podcast. Welcome back, guys.
Thanks, John.
So, we're talking about the Beatles on TV these days because of the 50th anniversary. That's pretty obvious. What about the Beatles' impact on the silver screen in film?
Well, I think you can't really... You can't underestimate the impact of some of those early Beatles movies, particularly something like Hard Day's Night, which just really gave you such a great flavor of the way the Beatles interacted, the way they behaved, their kind of their energy, this this youth that they had.
I can hear eyebrows being raised all over the place, though, from skeptics, Kristen, who think the Beatles as actors, as people with an impact on film?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the big challenges with the Beatles, much like any big star like Elvis or Oprah, somebody whose personality is so huge and who's known as that icon, it's sometimes hard to separate them from being an icon to being an actor, which I think is one of the reasons why these Beatles movies, they're usually themselves.
Well, that seems to be quite the point of it, wasn't it?
That's true. I mean, that's true. It's not that any of the Beatles ever wound up being actual actors the way that someone like David Bowie or Frank Sinatra wound up doing. But you know, to give you a sense of just what they were like and what it would be like to kind of hang out with the Beatles, those early films are really great.
Now, A Hard Day's Night, how long after these historic Ed Sullivan appearances did people first get a chance to see Hard Day's Night?
Well, Hard Day's Night was in 1964, I think it was.
Same year.
Same year, right. And I think, you know, Beatlemania was kind of cresting at the time. And you can see it in the way that they're being chased by all the girls down the street. You know, the way wherever they go, they have to break into song, obviously. It's all very, very early music video with Hard Day's Night.
And how did it do with the critics?
I think the critics liked it okay. I mean, I think it was not you know, it was clearly not a movie in the way that maybe you would expect when you were going in. But it was also the kind of film that I think there was something irresistible about it. I think you couldn't, even though it was clearly a marketing ploy, mm-hmm. it was so easy to fall in love with these guys. And there was something about, even though they were, you know, all singing together on the, you know, on a railway car, suddenly with a great orchestration and beautiful production behind them, you kind of forgave that for them, you know, anyway.
So this is from the very beginning of the film, where the Beatles have just outrun a bunch of crazy female fans and hopped on a train, and they're talking about Paul's grandfather, who has unexpectedly joined them.
Well, my mother thought the trip would do him good.
How's that?
He's nursing a broken heart.
Ah, poor old thing. Hey, mister, are you nursing a broken heart? He's a nice old man, isn't he?
He's very clean.
Hello, grandfather.
Hello.
He can talk then, can he?
Of course he can talk. He's a human being, isn't he?
Well, if he's your grandfather, who knows?
But I love that.
That is the least convincing laugh I have ever heard.
I think that's what they call a stage laugh there. But you can hear too in there the whole, you know, younger generation versus older generation tension that I think, you know, made the Beatles so great. There's another great scene with an old stuffy British passenger who says, you know,
"Don't take that tone with me, young man. I fought the war for your sort.
I bet you saw you won."
They're not actors, really. I mean, they're not even good at acting as themselves.
I might kind of disagree. I really think in Hard Day's Night and Help, their two early films, I think they really have a great chemistry and a great rapport together. And even though they're kind of a little bit following a script, a little bit ad-libbing, they all have a real charisma and a real chemistry that I think mm-hmm. comes off the screen. And, you know, even George gets the quiet one gets a few lines in here and there. But I think they're actually quite good as themselves. That's just me.
All right. But with Help, 1965 movie, the premise here is the boys all live in one house. The joke is they each have separate doors to
yes.
get in.
Yes.
And this is a clip from that early film from the Beatles.
Hey, someone's got a hold of me finger. Are you trying to attract attention again? She's pulling us.
Oh, gee! Ow!
She had me finger, you know.
Stop trying to drag things down to your own level. It's immature, son.
I thought she was a sandwich. Till she went spare on me hand.
Help.
You sound unimpressed, John. You sound unimpressed.
You know, you can almost tell when they're actually reading lines.
Yes.
I mean, it does sound like they're
a little more stilted in some lines than others when they're allowed to ad lib. But the thing is, and we see it later with Magical Mystery Tour, it's this kind of sense of the absurd. I mean, you said before it wasn't like a movie. So what was it?
Help, yeah. Well, I think Help actually was their attempt to be something more of a movie.
More literally narrative.
Yes, yeah, it had an actual plot. You hear, you might hear Ringo talking about his finger there, and he's talking about a ring that's gotten trapped on his finger. It's a ridiculous plot. You know, there's some bad guys. Leo McKern plays one of the bad guys. Eleanor Braun, great British comedian, are trying to get Ringo, and I think they're going to hold some kind of crazy sacrifice that's going to do something. And, you know, so it's a ridiculous plot, but and I think critics liked it a little bit less than Hard Day's Night, perhaps for that reason.
And yet they were very effective as promotional tools for the respective records.
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, all of them, Hard Day's Night, Help, Yellow Submarine, Magical Mystery Tour, which was a television movie.
Right.
The movie was – that was really the Beatles' first big misstep, and that was the first time that the critics actually came out and said, hey, this stinks.
No business like show business. There's no business I know. Everything about it's so appealing.
Just because you're the Beatles doesn't mean you can do anything you want. But the record is still great, I think. I love that record.
Yeah, I do too.
I am he as you are.
We're talking about the Beatles, not on disc necessarily, and not even on TV, though we've been talking a lot about that with the 50th anniversary of the Ed Sullivan shows this month. But we're talking with Kristen Meinzer and Rafer Guzman about the Beatles on film here in the Soundcheck studio. Did either of you grow up watching these movies? I mean, were they available to watch other than, 1964 in a movie theater?
I mean, I had to go seek them out as a kid. I have a recollection, though, of seeing some of these things on television. Yellow Submarine, perhaps, on television.
Well, yeah, I remember seeing that on TV, too.
Yeah, but that was back in the day when you had to go seek that stuff out.
We all live in a yellow submarine. Yellow submarine. Yellow submarine. We all live in a yellow submarine. Yellow submarine. Yellow submarine.
Same for me. I think Yellow Submarine on TV was pretty much the limit of it. For me, the Beatles were always a soundtrack, not just in my household, but in the movies. And that's why they're really important to me, partly, just to listen to. But they add so much to the movies that they're in.
Well, now, here's that's kind of surprising because the Beatles have been very reticent about letting their music out there for that sort of thing.
Absolutely. They have. But that doesn't mean the music doesn't get used. It gets remade a lot.
Yeah.
Yes.
So actual Beatles recordings, not so much, but Beatles songs being covered. Give me an example, Kristen, of a movie where the soundtrack is Beatles songs maybe being covered by great singers, great artists.
Well, there are a few of them. And usually the reason why you have a whole soundtrack of remakes versus a whole soundtrack of Beatles songs is, as you were saying, it's not easy to get the rights to those songs. But Sean Penn tried to get the rights to all the songs for his movie I Am Sam back in 2001. That's the movie where he plays a developmentally disabled father. His daughter, played by Dakota Fanning, who's 7 years old, is possibly going to be taken away from him. And how do we deal with the simpleton on the surface versus the complex feelings that are underneath? Those great Beatles pop songs, which I think just mirror all of that. Mm. And he didn't want to have covers, but in the end he had to because he couldn't get the rights. And the covers, I think, turned out beautifully. They're just fantastic. One of my favorite songs is by Rufus Wainwright. He does a version of Across the Universe that is just so stunningly, achingly beautiful. And again, like the main character in the movie, looks simple on the surface, but so intricate underneath.
Words are flowing out like endless rain into a paper cup. They slither while they pass, they slip away across the universe. Pools of sorrow, waves of joy are drifting through my open mind, possessing and caressing me. Jai Guru Deva. Nothing's gonna change. it's gonna change my world. Nothing's gonna change my world. Nothing's gonna change my world.
That is Rufus Wainwright in his version of the Beatles' Across the Universe, used in the 2001 movie I Am Sam. We're speaking with Kristen Meinzer and Rafer Guzman, co-hosts of the Takeaways Movie Date podcast, about the Beatles on and in film, either on in their own movies, as with Hard Day's Night and Help, or their songs coloring other people's movies. That's a really beautiful arrangement.
Isn't it unbelievable? That soundtrack is incredible. I highly recommend folks listen to it. There's Ben Folds on it, The Vines. Like, you wouldn't believe the talent that's on here, Amy Mann.
And you know, there is something to be said for other people doing Beatles songs, because those original recordings are so iconic that they're sort of monolithic. You know, there's not much that you can do with them. They just are what they are. Whereas somebody else singing a song kind of...
It brings something completely different to it, completely different. When you hear that Rufus Wainwright version of Across the Universe, it's very haunting, I think.
Kristen, is it true that you are not a fan of the film American Beauty?
It is really one of the most overrated films of all time. I just think it's a bunch of garbage, so derivative, seems about 10 years too late with all of these breakthrough ideas in the film. I really... just think that I don't understand why it's considered a great film. I have no idea of why.
Is there nothing in the movie that has any redeeming quality for you?
Okay, so I know what you're trying to do here, John. I know what you're trying to do with me. You're trying to bring up Elliott Smith and his cover of a Beatles song and his version of Because. Of course it's going to be great. Of course it's going to be moving because it's Elliott Smith and it's the Beatles together. And the Beatles are sometimes used as emotional, manipulative shorthand in a movie, and I'm usually fine with that. This movie is so awful. This is probably the only good thing about this movie is this song in this film.
Because the world is round, it turns me on. Because the world is round. Because the wind is high, it blows my mind. Because the wind is high. Love is old, love is new. Love is old, love is new.
From the soundtrack to the movie American Beauty, which two of the three of us think is a beautiful movie and one of us is rather more curmudgeonly about.
I like to think a critical thinker.
Elliott Smith's version of the Beatles' Because. Kristen Meinzer, Rafer Guzman, co-hosts of the Takeaways Movie Date podcast. Now, there is an upcoming Brian Epstein biopic. Brian Epstein, of course, the Beatles' longtime manager. And word on the street is that this will be the first feature film to actually use Beatles recordings. Not just Beatles songs, but actual Beatles recordings. The movie's going to be called The Fifth Beatle. You know, we had the subject of the documentary Good Old Frida, their longtime secretary on Soundcheck, and they actually got, like, permission to use two songs, which was a big deal.
Right.
So the idea of a feature film, Kristen, with actual Beatles recordings, is that something to look forward to, or is that?
I just think it's such a peculiar curiosity at this point. We've spent 50 years not having that, and I'm going to be curious to see what that's going to feel like or look like. But as you were saying earlier, these songs are just they're like monuments in and of themselves. So is that going to actually detract from the movie in any way? Are we going to suddenly be taken outside of the story because we're going to be in that reverie in that moment with the Beatles songs? I'll be curious to see how it feels.
Yeah. Well, of course, this is one movie that where
it makes sense in this movie, actually.
It won't actually take you out of the story. It's just, will it deflect attention from the so-called Fifth Beatle, which is the title of the film?
I think it'd be very difficult not to have the Beatles music in that. I think it would be weirder to not have it in a film like that, you know?
Well, that's down the road. At the moment, we're in the midst of the 50th anniversary run of the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show, and we've taken a little time out from the small screen to look at the Beatles on the big screen with Kristen Meinzer and Rafer Guzman, co-hosts of the Takeaways Movie Date podcast. Kristen, Rafer, always great to have you guys with us on Soundcheck.
Thanks, John.
Always great to be here.
I give her all my love, that's all I do. And if you saw my love, you'd love her too. I love her.
From the soundtrack to A Hard Day's Night, the song And I Love Her by the Beatles. And according to our listener, May, this is the most romantic song ever. Why? May writes, those first four notes, the simple lyrics, because it's the Beatles, and it's all about love. Thanks, May. You can post your pick for the most romantic song ever at soundcheck.org or leave us a voicemail, 866-939-1612. We might use your story on the air. Again, that's 866-939-1612. Up next, more than 30 years into his career, one of the founding members of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers is releasing his first solo album. Keyboardist and pianist Benmont Tench joins us to play songs from his new record. And later, the mysterious allure of a four-note musical pattern called the Andalusian Cadence. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. If you've ever heard a song by Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, or seen them in concert, or watched a video, you know that fella behind the keyboards, Benmont Tench. He's an essential part of that Heartbreakers sound. But you might not know that this gentlemanly, well-traveled pianist has been crafting his own songs, and now, for the first time in his 37-year career, he's releasing a solo album, with some help from his friends, like Tom Petty and Ringo Starr. More about that in a moment, but first, here's Benmont Tench at our piano with a song called Veronica Said.
Stared at the ring on her hand. She said nothing in life goes according to plan, for you cannot control what you can't understand, so you make what you can of the moment. Veronica shivered and paused for effect, pulled a windbreaker tight, lit a fresh cigarette. She said nothing turns out like you led to expect, so you take what you have and you hold it. And the wind's blowing cold on the waterfront tonight, and the winter's so close you can taste it. We got nothing but plenty of time on our hands, and so many ways we can waste it, waste it. Veronica straightened and looked at the sky, turned her back to the moon as it started to rise. She said, not every word in this world is a lie. Those who cannot trust cannot be trusted. And the wind's blowing cold on the waterfront tonight. The winter's so close you can taste it. We got nothing but plenty of time on our hands, and so many ways we can waste it, waste it. out in the night, someone laughed at a joke. Veronica's eyes caught the light as she spoke. She said, I'll tell you one thing, it isn't all smoke. You can raise yourself up, you can lay yourself low. You can receive the most inconceivable blow. But wherever you are and wherever you go, there is one thing to say, there is one thing to know. So hold on to this tight and hold on to this close. It'll serve you and save you in high and high low. That whatever the depth to which you sink below, no true innocent can be corrupted. And the wind's blowing cold on the waterfront tonight. The winter's so close you can taste it. We got nothing but plenty of time on our hands, and so many ways we can waste it. And the wind's blowing cold on the waterfront tonight. And the winter's so close you can taste it. We got nothing but plenty of time on our hands. There's so many ways we can waste it, waste it.
Ben Montench, live at our piano, and his song called Veronica Said, which is part of Benmont's new record called You Should Be So Lucky. It doesn't come out till February 18th, but we're getting a bit of a preview. Ben Montench, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Hey, how are you?
Good, good. On the album, you play that song on guitar.
Yeah, on the album, it's on electric guitar.
When did you start playing guitar?
When I was about 10.
Uh-huh.
And I'm terrible at it. And that one, for some reason, I played guitar on the record, it worked fine, but when I play it by myself on the guitar, it doesn't quite have the same thing. It's an entirely different character on the piano, but I thought, what
did you write it on the guitar?
I wrote it on the guitar, yeah.
Ooh, okay.
Absolutely.
We know you as an ace keyboard player. I would have just thought that that's the instrument you go to when it's time to write a song.
I write a lot of them when I'm just walking down the street or driving in the car without an instrument anywhere nearby. And then when I get home, I have to figure out what to do. That one I wrote on the guitar, though.
Yeah. So you've been writing these songs now for how long? I mean, your career goes back almost 40 years.
I've been writing songs since I was a kid, and the oldest song on this record is probably from 78 or something like that. And the newest song on the record was written, 2 weeks to 30 days before the record was recorded.
The album's called You Should Be So Lucky, and Tom Petty appears on a track playing bass.
Yeah, because when I first played with him, he was the bass player.
Mm-hmm. Ryan Adams, Don Was is on this record.
Yeah, Don's known as a producer, but he's one of the best bass players I can name.
Yeah.
He's one of my favorite bass players.
Gillian Welch and David Rawlings. How did Ringo Starr end up playing Tamburino Magnifico? I think I've said that right.
Well, I mean, what else would you call it?
I don't know.
You know, it's
did you call Ringo
tambourine.
In to specifically play tambourine?
No, we're friends, and originally I wanted him to play drums on the song that Tom played bass on, but we got our wires crossed as to what day I was cutting it, so he wasn't free, and we cut it with Jeremy playing drums, and Jeremy Stacy, who played the rest of the record
right.
as well. Jeremy's a great drummer, so I was thoroughly happy with what he did. But when I talked to Ringo, I was like, oh, well, heck, man, come on in. And there was something that wasn't working between the way the vocals went and the way the instruments went. And he put the tambourine on, and it just worked.
Blonde girl in a blue dress. She's walking away from me. She's standing so still, but she's walking away. Green eyes on the blue day. Black birds in a field of white. Blonde girl in the blue dress, and she's walking away. Have you ever come so close? Have you ever
ever just touched down? Have you ever come so close that you could almost, you could almost?
Ben Montench from the album called You Should Be So Lucky. That's called Blonde Girl, Blue Dress, with Ringo Starr on tambourine, Tom Petty on bass, Gillian Welch and David Rawlings helping out with guitars and harmonies. And
yeah.
So it's a star-studded album. Now, you mentioned, Benmont, that when you first met Tom Petty, he was a bass player. How did you meet Tom Petty?
Well, I saw him around. He was one of this crowd of older kids that worked at a music store that I haunted from when I was about 11. And they were very sinister looking. They had longer hair, and it turns out they were all in a band. And since they were about 3 years older than I was when I was 11, they were very, you know, like, that's a big age difference.
Yeah.
And then a friend of mine started helping them carry their equipment around. And a couple of years later, you know, I went to see them play, and they said, sit in some night. And I sat in, and I played with them whenever I was home from college, and eventually I quit college. My father was a judge, and I quit college. And I basically chicken quit college. I didn't tell my dad I wasn't going back because I knew there'd be hell to pay. And so time comes to go to college, and I just don't go and don't go. And eventually he and my mom got wise. And he was pretty mad. And Tom talked to him and said, look, I don't know what Tom said to him, but because my dad was a very wise man who was not going to be fooled by anybody, but Tom talked to him, and my dad didn't throw me out of the house. I always figured Tom talked to him to keep me from crashing on Tom's couch, you know?
So the album's called You Should Be So Lucky, solo album by Ben Montench. It is your, it's your first solo record,
yeah, I've
right?
never done this before.
Why now?
Because it was time to do something scary. And because Glenn Johns had said over the years, let's do a record, and I finally went, what the heck am I doing not taking him up on this offer?
Right. So you Glenn know. Johns, who produced Led Zeppelin and, I mean...
Yeah, he engineered the first Zeppelin record, produced the first couple Eagles record, produced some Faces stuff, you know, engineered a ton of Rolling Stones, for the Beatles,
yeah.
Good
yeah.
Lord. So, it goes on and on and on and on. I think he may have done You Really Got Me for the Kinks. He may have engineered that.
Glenn Johns produced. The album is called You Should Be So Lucky. It comes out on February 18th. My guest is Ben Montench. Now, the next song you're going to play on the album, this one is on piano, but you're about to play it on guitar.
It's got electric piano on the album, but I like the mood of it better on the guitar, and I'm not a guitar player.
As you told us before.
So I'm gonna give it a shot.
All right.
You know?
Well, there's the guitar. You want to strap
okay,
it on?
Let me see if I can figure this one out.
Ben Montench is my guest on Soundcheck, pianist, guitarist, vocalist, songwriter. The album's called You Should Be So Lucky, and this is the title track in a live performance here in the Soundcheck studio, Ben Montench on guitar.
Well, you should be so lucky. You should be so sly as to take my fancy, as to strike my eye. Yeah, you should be all that. You should have such stuff. Well, you should be so lucky that I would give. Who told you I was looking? Who said that I was out for any piece of the action that you were all about? Did you think you're so high? Did you think me so low? Did you think you were the question to which I couldn't say no? Well, you should be so lucky. Life should be so sweet as to find yourself one man that's worth a tenth of me, with a heart so strong and an eye so clear
Well, you should be so lucky as to make it out of here. From the day we met, I knew that we were meant for disgrace or glory, hell or heaven bent. Look into my eyes, my little baby blue. Bend your ear to my lips and let me tell you the news. Under another sky, under another sun, maybe some other guy say that you were the one, but that's another story, and this one's already been told. I hate to spoil the ending, but you are coming in from the cold. Well, ain't the river pretty, just like a picture book? Come and walk beside me, we'll take a closer look. Show a little trust, put your hand in mine, and I'll show you lucky while the waters rise. Yeah, you should be so lucky, your life should be so sweet, as to find yourself one man this worth a tenth of me. You should be all that, you should have such stuff. Well, you should be so lucky, but now your luck is all used up. Yeah, you should be so lucky, but now your luck is all used up.
That is Ben Montench with You Should Be So Lucky, his song from the album of the same name, which comes out on February 18th. We've been getting a little bit of a preview as Ben Montench has been performing here on Soundcheck, and this has been a lot of fun. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much for having me in.
If you enjoyed this session with Ben Montench, there's more music and conversation on our website. Just head over to soundcheck.org to listen on demand or subscribe to our free podcast. And follow us on Twitter or like us on Facebook to get the latest updates about live webcasts of these sessions from the Soundcheck studio. Up next, my WNYC colleague David Garland joins us. The host of Spinning on Air will reveal the amazing versatility and durability of a four-note musical pattern. It's called the Andalusian Cadence. It sounds like a death blow in the martial arts, but it's not. You'll find out what it is and how to spot it in your record collection next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. You're probably familiar with this song, Hit the Road, Jack, by Ray Charles, but have you really listened to it? I mean, really dug deep, listened to that bass line? Because there's some pretty deep musical roots here. A sequence of notes that has been reinterpreted many times for hundreds of years. David Garland, the host of WNYC's Spinning on Air, has identified more than 50 tracks from across Western music that have this same musical footprint. You can find a link to his playlist on our website, soundcheck.org, and he joins me here in the Soundcheck studio
to talk about why this four-note pattern is so ubiquitous. Hi, David.
Hi, John. It's good to be here.
So let's bring back Ray Charles for a second here. Tell us what specific sequence of chords we're listening for.
Hit the road, Jack. Don't you come back no more. Da, 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 da.
That's the bass line.
Yes.
The bass line here.
It's also the chord sequence, really. It's more than just that line of the... There's more to it. It's harmonized in this way.
A minor, G, F, and D is what you just played on the guitar.
Ending
there.
On it, A minor, G, F, E.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what is that?
That is the diatonic Phrygian tetrachord.
Of course.
At least it is in its sort of single line form. Harmonized in the way I played it, it's known as the Andalusian cadence.
Uh-huh. Is it from Andalusian or flamenco music originally?
Well, it's closely associated with that, but whether or not it's from there is anyone's guess, I think. The interesting thing is Andalusia is the southern tip of Spain, so not far from Africa. So did this little chord sequence come from Africa as so much other music and people did?
Yeah.
I don't know. Possibly.
So those four notes, whether they're harmonized or not, we find them, or you found them, in so many different types of music. How do you go looking for this stuff? Did you crowdsource this? How did this work?
I did a little of that, but it was actually a process of listening for years and years and just making notes. I did a spinning on-air program on this a couple of years ago, but didn't include nearly as many examples as I did in the new show. I think what first made me particularly conscious of it is a piece for solo violin by a Baroque composer named Heinrich Ignaz Franz von Bieber. It's all a solo violin piece that elaborates on the same bass line that's found in Hit the Road, Jack. And loving that piece made me recognize it in Hit the Road, Jack, and so many other songs. And I just sort of kept a running list and then asked a few friends, musician friends, for suggestions and learned about a few more.
And then found out what this thing is called.
Yes.
The diatonic Phrygian tetrachord.
Yeah. Tetrachord is a chord of four notes, and the whole idea of thinking of it in those terms goes back to the ancient Greeks.
Mm-hmm.
And it's totally possible that this sequence of notes goes that far back.
So if we're in the key of C, we'd be talking about C, B-flat, A-flat, G.
Exactly.
So you end up on the dominant fifth.
That's right. And that circles you right back to the tonic.
Right.
And so this becomes a very circular and continuous, almost like a...
Like a round?
Yes, and a backdrop for elaboration and storytelling.
Yeah.
You know, I think of the ancient Greeks and their lyres tuned in this way and think of them reciting Homer and, you know, it becomes a kind of journey. It's got a momentum. It's a frame for a story.
So it wants to repeat because
yes.
It cycles back. So
that's
we'll
right.
hear it repeating in all of these songs that are on David's edition of Spinning on Air devoted to this diatonic Phrygian tetrachord. But here's just a couple of excerpts beginning with Nina Simone.
With a joy that's hard to hide. And then sometimes again it seems that all I have is worry. And then you're bound to see my other side.
Must my love do me wrong to treat
faster than that U2 song. It's boom, 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 boom.
Exactly. And as you heard in Hit the Road, Jack, sometimes the sequence goes quickly. But in the U2, the pace is more like dun, dun, you know, that kind of thing.
So in listening for this, you have to listen beneath the melody very
That's right.
often.
There's, I think in all like 57 excerpts that I included on my show, there's only one song that actually sort of uses it as the melody. It's always the accompaniment. But I think for listeners, that's part of the fun because you're listening past the things that are usually taking your attention and you're listening a little deeper to the things that is underlying it all, the sequence that's underlying it all.
Yeah. What is that one song that uses it as the theme?
It's a kind of an obscure one by a guy named Jerry Jeff Walker. It's called The Ballad of the Hulk. And it's kind of a protest song from the 60s.
The cycle of life is here to see in all its fine simplicity, but the way we live it seems to be something very weird to me, and I cry out.
We're speaking with David Garland, the host of WNYC's Spinning on Air, which for lo these many years has been devoted to all kinds of unusual music. And recently, David has put together a whole program based on this sequence of notes, four notes descending, a whole tone, whole tone, whole tone, half tone.
Yeah.
You, on your show, talk about the collective unconscious.
Yes.
How this might be something that we just kind of tap into without even realizing why. And as I look at this really extensive playlist of songs that goes from classical to jazz to rock to all forms of pop, it is mostly Western. And I'm kind of hard-pressed to, even after hearing this dozens of different ways, to think of examples of this, say, in East Asian music or sub-Saharan African music and stuff.
Yeah, I'm very interested to find further examples from other parts of the world. I've heard it in Arabic music.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of sensible, especially with the Andalusian connection.
Right, and which was, a formative influence on Western classical music. We get the piano and the guitar from Arab music.
Mm-hmm. And so I expect a lot more examples could be found there. I have a few examples from South America, and I'm sure there are many more, especially because of the Spanish influence there. And, you know, it's not so far from the most essential sort of Japanese scale. So I think you will find reverberations of this sequence in other parts of the world. But I think it is maybe mainly a Western music phenomenon. I don't know.
Yeah.
I do really think that it's embedded somehow in the makeup of the human brain.
Well, you've played the guitar for many years. I have too. Every person who's ever played the guitar has somehow found their way to this A minor G F E. You know, you bar the chord and you just work your way down the neck. So it's sort of built into the instrument in a way.
Yes, but it certainly predates the guitar. And a lot of us noodling around on the guitar are when we discover that the we're not thinking, I'm playing Hit the Road, Jack or something. You just think, hey, that sounds good.
And you don't know, hey, I just found an Andalusian cadence or a Phrygian tetrachord. you find something that works.
Right.
And here are some more examples of this diatonic Phrygian tetrachord in action from this playlist that David Garland has put together.
Around, leaves are brown, and the sky is a hazy shade of winter.
that four-note progression, David, is really evident in two of the three songs we just heard. I mean, Blank Generation, Richard Hell and the Voidoids, pretty easy. Moondog builds that whole piece around the diatonic Phrygian tetrachord,
right,
and actually uses it as a cadence.
That's, you know, there, right there in the kettle drums.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But sort of true to form, Simon and Garfunkel, that you were talking about, the Baroque composer von Bieber, who uses it as like a platform for all kinds of filigrees and ornamentations. Simon and Garfunkel kind of doing the same thing in Hazy Shade of Winter.
Yeah, it's coming and going. It's present in the chorus, but not throughout. Of course, many composers have done this. They make use of it. It's there in the opening bars of Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata, but Beethoven doesn't just stay with it and repeat it. He elaborates and goes on to other things. But I think one reason the progression is so powerful and compelling is its simplicity. You could hardly, you know, two chords don't really make a sequence. Mm-hmm. You can kind of pivot back and forth, and a lot of songs have used just two chords or three. But this series of four is the one that sort of carries you effectively. Like you say, it becomes this kind of platform or a foundation that's easy to elaborate on. And that's what Moondog was doing, just like Bieber did. Mm-hmm. You know, the kettle drums were repeating that sequence, and the brass was elaborating and...
And he did, as I say, use it as a cadence, which in musicological terms is something that happens once at the end, brings you back and sets you down where, you know, at the note that you started from. So he might well have known, hey, I'm going to put an Andalusian cadence here or build my piece on this tetrachord. But
sure,
as you say, most people just kind of find their way to it and maybe don't even know that that's what they're doing.
Yeah, I really can't imagine that in the 57 examples I include in my show, there's any plagiarism going on. You know, people just keep discovering this.
So why don't we get sick of it?
That's a good question. I think it's the momentum that's generated by it. And its simplicity, it's concise, it moves, it carries you with it in this kind of turning wheel that travels through time and history.
Well, now, I mentioned before, you can see David Garland's full playlist of his Spinning on Air show devoted to this four-note sequence at soundcheck.org. But if you go to the actual show page, you can hear the whole program, and then there's all these comments from listeners saying, well, what about this song and that piece?
Yeah.
And so... You know, for the 57 that you have could easily spawn another 57.
And I think so, yeah.
One of your listeners suggested the White Stripes song, Seven Nation Army. Take a listen and let me know if this fits into the diatonic Phrygian tetrachord family. Is it in there?
Yeah, I think so. It's the guitar's a little out of tune with the recording, but it's... So it's there. It's not stated explicitly, but that's one of the beauties of finding this in pieces. Once you start to learn how to listen for it and you know what you're listening for, you'll find it in places where it's not explicit, but it is there, underlying the structure.
All right. So thanks to David Garland and to some of his listeners for pointing us in still more directions to find this sequence of four notes. David Garland is host of WNYC's Spinning on Air. David, good to see you.
Good to see you, John. Thanks.
There's a lot more where this came from. If you want to dive even deeper into the Andalusian cadence, you can find a link to David Garland's latest episode of Spinning on Air at soundcheck.org. And
As the Winter Games continue in Sochi, our series, From Russia with Soundcheck, is taking a look at Russian music and pop culture. Tomorrow, the legacy of the punk movement in Siberia. And the new album from Tom Brousseau is called Grass Punks, but it's no hardcore record. The singer and guitarist brings his gentle California folk sound to our studio for a live performance. Plus, disastrous love songs in a special Valentine's Day edition of our occasional series, That Was a Hit. And more of your nominations for the most romantic song ever, which we're collecting on soundcheck.org, or tweet us at soundcheck. That does it for the show today. It's a packed one tomorrow. Join us then. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.